Welcome back to the New Talk, the Bob Davis Podcasts. Yes, it is Friday morning. Actually, it is Friday morning. Usually when I do these radio show podcasts, I do it, in the afternoon, and I say it's the morning. But it's indeed the morning, and we're doing laundry next door, so we have the sound of the dryer and the spinner next door. Planes are landing, and I'm slowly getting back to normal over here after getting back from the mega trip and this insane election that we had. So this is the Bob Davis Podcast radio show number 52. So I've done a year's worth of these radio shows already. It's so bizarre to look and say, oh my God, I number them, because I number them week by week. So 52 weeks of the radio show. This is number 52. New content for the podcasts. So it's not a repeat. It's not, I'm not excerpting in the radio show. I did four new segments. So four mini podcasts, basically, just reviewing some of the stuff in, have some coffee, just reviewing some takeaways from this election and some, and basically, tempering expectations on both sides of the political spectrum. From the people who are terrified, which is just hilarious, to the people who think that, it's the second coming of Reagan and all these things are going to change. So here we go with podcast 571, the radio show for this week. Welcome to the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. For all the podcasts, visit the BobDavisPodcasts.com. Well, it's good to be home back in the studio after traveling for an entire month in October of 2016 on the eve of the big election 2016 that we just had this last week. It is an interesting experience traveling across the country, especially working in my Ford Super Duty 450 ambulance. I've been listening to the podcast. You know that I've been doing that. It's a very tiny little primitive space, and it works well for just mobile podcasting, but I am also living in that thing, traveling around the country. And if you've been listening to the radio show and if you've been listening to the podcast, you've heard some of my discussion about that. It's kind of an interesting experience. And then you get back home and it's a whole different thing that you have to readjust to. But yeah, I have been all over the country, you know, went across from Minneapolis to Seattle, down through San Francisco to Los Angeles, across the desert, Palm Springs and Joshua Tree to Phoenix, and then on down through southeastern Arizona, out into New Mexico, White Sands, through the mountains, across the Texas Panhandle, and on through Oklahoma, all the way back up to Minneapolis and St. Paul. So I've seen the great north and southwest, the mountains and the plains, the cities, the suburbs, and the rural areas. I saw the Trump signs all over the farmlands. This year, between trips to both coasts and covering the primaries, I've actually had the opportunity to see most of the United States, starting with the Scott Walker announcement going back into the summer of 2015 over there in Waukesha, Wisconsin. And I would have to say that there is nothing like the United States in the world. I again am struck by how vibrant of a country this is. This is not the country that the talk radio charlatans and the cable news pundits and the online conspiracy theorists are painting a picture of. I saw people working together, from the big family that said grace in the big restaurant in Oklahoma, and everybody watched them do it, and nobody said anything, and they considered it completely natural, to the homeless woman named Brenda that I interviewed at the Republican convention in Cleveland, who told me that God had chosen Donald Trump, right? All the way out to Palo Alto, which was an amazing place. It's like a Disneyland city. It's crazy. A storybook place in the heart of Silicon Valley, dripping with money, dripping with abundance and success. So now we have a new president of this country, the United States, with this, quote, surprise election, which I'm going to talk about in this show. And we have a lot of different ideas about what Donald J. Trump is, what he might and might not do, what he will or will not be, and what he will become as president. None of them rooted in any reality. Seeing lots of arguments in social media about what's going to happen, protests in the streets already, out in Washington, also in Minneapolis. And you have the mayor of Minneapolis getting in the midst of all this with posts on Facebook, and everybody's all upset, all over the shock and surprise. Some think it's the end of the world. Other people are thinking that the new president will solve all of the problems that we have. And everybody right now is projecting their beliefs, positive and negatives, onto one person, one office. And yet, how many times did we have to talk about electing 435 representatives and senators and local elections and local initiatives being voted on all over the country? And so to a lesser extent, people are posting and pushing and projecting their beliefs onto one or the other party about what they and he are or are not. So as I did in the election, I'm going to say again that I did not endorse either candidate. In fact, I didn't support at all either candidate, and I didn't support any candidate for president or, for that matter, any office. And I also did not predict outcomes. I gave you probabilities. I suggested paths. I never said this is what's going to happen. And when I say probabilities, I don't mean indexes and numbers and that nonsense and voodoo and tarot card reading. What I'm talking about is basically saying, here are some ideas about what could happen. Here are some ideas that would, you know, on the other side that could happen. So in this show, we're going to talk a little bit about the real losers of this election, which in fact is the media, and in particular, the pundits and the predictors and the cribbers and what I like to refer to as the tarot card readers and astrologists that seem to have taken over political analysis in this country. And I want to talk about the strange candidacy of Donald Trump. And I want to talk about the parameters you might consider on both sides of the political spectrum going forward. We're going to do that probably at the end of the hour. And as far as the media is concerned, and this now includes new media and broadcast media and cable media and magazines and newspapers, the whole enchilada, this penchant for predicting the future, this penchant for telling the story no one is telling without any facts at all. So they're just making it up as they go along, usually based on some quote or opinion or something that someone did that is then turned into news. Principals turning their personalities into news. If I saw it once on the campaign trail, I saw it again and again and again. Look, it is a fact that there was almost no reporting on issues in the last 18 months. It was all reaction to stimuli provided by candidates or their campaigns. Think about it. How much do you really know about North Korea or Iran? What do you really know about Russia's intentions or their capabilities? How up are you on the politics, military development, sociology, and economy of the Middle East or Western Iraq or Eastern Iraq or the troop deployments the U.S. still has in Afghanistan? How deep is your knowledge of the specific economic issues related to growth or the federal budget or debt or monetary issues facing the country? What about the so-called Rust Belt versus the so-called Silicon Valley? What is the manufacturing output of the United States related to the rest of the world, especially as it relates to employment in this country? How much do we know about the details of trade deals like NAFTA and TPP, and where did your information come from? And what is trade protection? And what is free trade? And what is supply-side economics? And what would a metals-based currency mean or not? What is this fiat currency everyone talks about? And what about the so-called social issues? Those who voted Democratic or didn't, education, transportation, infrastructure, do we need our infrastructure rebuilt? What does that mean? Health insurance and the health insurance markets and the makeup of the new Congress, the six new Democratic congressmen, the two new Democratic senators, tighter Republican majorities for the Republicans, especially in the Senate. What does all this mean politically? And what is our fluency on these issues? Well, we didn't hear much about any of that because we weren't talking about issues in this election. You see, opinion on television and on the front page of newspapers like the New York Times is the order of the day, even down to the wringing of hands post-election about what it's going to mean to Obama's legacy and what it's going to mean to the future of the country and all of that. Opinion passed off as news. You see opinion on social media presented as fact. Is it? You see opinion presented on YouTube and on CNN and on all these sources. How do we know what real information is versus the stuff that is made up? Well, you don't. Because you see, if you supported Donald Trump, the candidate, and I applaud people who worked for candidates and got involved, but if you supported a candidate or a person with a name and a party and everything else, you're already going to see the opposition forming. You're going to see an enraged left that will use protests and frustration to build a strong opposition to President Trump's policies, and his supporters will be left to defend him. So if you supported Trump, are you prepared to defend him? And how are you prepared to defend him? Well, without information, without really good reporting on issues, without knowing the issues, without any depth knowledge or in-depth knowledge about these things, supporters on both sides are in real trouble in terms of having arguments. And so this divide in the country continues because we're not dealing with quality information. We're going to talk more about that in this show because these are some of the important questions. And again, I'm going to emphasize the country that I see on television isn't the same country that I see when I travel. So we'll talk about it coming up next. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. To hear more of the podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts Radio Show.
Satan, your kingdom must come down. Satan, your kingdom must come down. I heard the voice of Jesus say, Satan, your kingdom must come down. Gonna pray until they tear your kingdom down.
Gonna pray. So just ahead of segment two, as you know, I ran out of Hydrus on the road, so I did this whole thing. The last time I talked about Hydrus, I did this whole thing about what it's like to do yoga, because when I got back, my friend Andy, I ordered a big pile of Hydrus for my friend Andy and his wife Nancy, and we were going to split it, and it took a while for it to get back to me up here in the Twin Cities, and I just got it. The last time I talked about Hydrus, I talked about what it's like to do yoga as much as I do without Hydrus. So I got my Hydrus this week, and I had already launched back into doing yoga. Immediately, I noticed that recovery is faster. I noticed that I feel better when I'm doing yoga. I noticed that the quality of my sweat is different. And it doesn't matter what you do for exercise. As you know, I practice yoga. I do hot yoga. I do power yoga. I do sculpts, although I didn't do any sculpts this week. But I thought that soreness went with the territory until they found Hydrus, and then Hydrus actually has transformed my yoga practice. What is it? It is a sports drink that uses new technology, which is very natural, to get electrolytes into your muscles and your cells really fast, and it works really fast. Sometimes when I flag in the middle of a class, just a couple of sips of Hydrus really makes a huge difference. And you can drink a gallon of water before a class like this, and you won't get fully hydrated until about 30 or 40 minutes in. This stuff works really fast, and this is why it makes such a huge difference. It's why tennis players and power lifters and wrestlers and CrossFit athletes and people, crazy people like me that do a lot of yoga, are using it. No sugar. It makes a huge difference. It'll help you take it to the edge. It will help you reach down and find the grit to get. I just double dipped last night and got up today early. Feel great. Join the performance hydration revolution. Doesn't matter what you do. Visit HydrusPerformance.com. That's HYDRUS HydrusPerformance.com. All right. Here is segment two of this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Back to the coffee. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcasts Radio Show. For all the podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. Well, I don't do this to brag, but I've learned when I talk about media to give my credentials a little bit, because people think of me as a talk show host or a podcaster, because I am a podcaster first. They don't realize that I've had a lot of experience in media and polling. So yeah, I'm an independent commentator and analyst, and I create and host and sell my own podcasts, and I'm engaged in this process of building a new media business. I do not work for, I will not work for candidates, foundations, advocates in the sense of creating content that you don't know is put out with the idea of advocating for some shadowy purpose. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of podcasters and bloggers doing work for other people, but you think you're just reading a blog about Hollywood or something. That is not me. There's no one behind me. It's me. During the election, I steadfastly refused to endorse anybody, and I refused to tell you how to vote, which I'm really proud of. I refused to reveal how I would vote. I refused to do somebody else's dirty work for them when it came to, you know, defending a candidate or someone else. And I will not defend a President Trump or Clinton or whomever in the future. Obviously, I won't be defending a President Clinton, but you know what I mean. I'm also not going to attack them needlessly, whether they are, you know, someone that I agree with politically or not, because there's no, I don't think it's helpful. I think it's actually harmful in terms of trying to get information out or present a point of view that people can think about. I spent a lot of years in broadcast radio, from writing news to music radio to marketing and research. I worked for a TV company for a while doing issue research. I did creative management and then back on the air as a talk host in Minneapolis and St. Paul and all over the country. I worked in small town radio, and I worked in New York City. I worked for small mom and pop companies, and then for huge publicly traded communications companies. I've emptied the trash. I had to mow the lawn at one station I worked for. I soldered wires. I took, you know, handed out bumper stickers. I worked weekends and the middle of the night, and managed radio stations and sat in boardrooms arguing about what to do with million-dollar properties and so on. So I have an understanding of media and the people in it and what has happened to media in this country that is tempered with a lot of experience in the trenches. And I don't talk a lot about it because, you know, I don't think people want to hear it, but I mention it because when I talk about media, people need to understand that the trenches is where I love to be. It's why I'm doing podcasting. It's why I'm running my own podcast business without any input from other people, aside from the fact that I'm selfish and, and interested in my stuff. This trench is the muddiest, water-filled, smokiest, and smelliest trench that I've ever been in, and it's the most fun. So that's my kind of background in media a little bit. And this is, you know, because I'm a media person, it's very tough to make some of these judgments that I've made about what is going on with media. But there are two losers, really, in this election. One is the media, and the other one is the rest of us, the public. The more I hear these cries about media bias, which I accept as a fait accompli, actually, the more I hear criticism of the media, especially the news media, the more I believe the average person simply doesn't understand the media, although almost all of us think that we are authorities on it, myself included. And of course, if you're in it and you're working in it, you've got your own list of things that you're working with and your own list of criticisms and ideas. Primarily, the biggest loser in this whole thing in 2016 is cable TV news as an institution in media, going back to the salad days, back in the early 90s when CNN was a brand new phenomenon and the arrival of Fox News as a right-leaning television network during the late 90s. Too many owners and managers in media, at least this is my opinion, are too busy looking at analytics and ratings meters to think about their product, which they put on the air with less and less resources, and with less and less thought, really, in terms of what it is and how it is. We are not seeing reporting so much these days as we see rehashing. People are rewriting something somebody else wrote. There is no time or money to put reporters on the ground in Syria or to sift through the source documents and tell a story about foreign policy based on fact or to make an effort to help people understand the economy. A reporter told me a story that he's doing a local story in Los Angeles on something, and he told me that someone said, you know, you're the only guy who's actually walked out to this thing that's actually talked to all the people involved. And there's, you know, big newspapers and big media companies in Los Angeles that could have done that, but they don't. They just write up what somebody else says. So there's a lot of competition for cable channels now from YouTube, where people who sit in front of a camera say stuff like what I'm doing, And they're getting much bigger audiences than CNN's weekly totals, for example, on some of these YouTube channels, whether they're conspiracy YouTube channels or people that are making an honest attempt to tell a story, but they don't have the resources of a newsroom to be able to uncover information. So much of the media is concentrated on telling you lurid stories about famous people's behavior and then telling you what that's going to mean in the broader picture. Not to mention, as I said, as I already have, the conspiracy videos, which garner millions of views, things like there will be no election. Obviously, that was wrong. Clinton will win. Obviously, that was wrong. Jesus is coming back on August 8th. No, wait, August 13th. No, wait, September. No, wait, next year. And those are my favorite videos, so I know they keep moving that up and so on. The result is we don't know whether the information we see is real or made up. And really, we don't have the ability to discern what is real or made up. My theory is your brain doesn't know what is fake and what isn't fake, whether you're talking about the New York Times or something that you see on YouTube. The source material is still out there and much of it available online. We can certainly access it. We can read the books. We can do searches. We can find out facts. We can read the documents. But we lack the expertise and experience and perspective to even know what to search most of the time for information. So we lack a context for what is going on to understand any of this stuff. And of course, the media doesn't provide any context in anything. So in a very real sense, we are living in an Orwellian paradigm where we see threats that aren't threats and we see non-threats that are threats, whether it's through surveillance and data mining combined with PSYOPs PR techniques leading to powerful emotional motivations and powerful emotional displays, violent protests, which can also be manipulated, and strong foregone conclusions about what somebody's going to do or won't do. Now, I blame the media for this, but there isn't any one person that you can point to. It's the messenger boys sent by grocery clerks to deliver a message mentality. Small thinking leads to small shows and small people repeating what other people say. And it's a far cry from the old days in the paper business, newspaper business, when editors sent out, you know, cub reporters who are great writers and great reporters and said, find something to write about. The antidote is you have to do your own homework. But how do you create the context? How do you learn history that you need to learn? Well, that's the whole thing. And that's the great challenge for all this is trying to create on our own the context for what is going on. I think we can start by turning it all off and listening to our own mind until it starts to calm down and then start to read. This is, of course, harder. It's easier said than done. But I'll talk about this more in future podcasts and radio shows. Okay, coming up. So remember, we're living in an Orwellian paradigm. And thinking of that, so coming up, you know, the predictions about what's going to happen and what Trump's going to do and how things are going to go and who's going to react to it and what it all means are just rampant. Whether it's social media or in the mainstream media, it's driving me crazy. We'll talk about that next. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show.
Autumn in New York. Why does it seem so inviting? Autumn in New York, it spells the thrill of first nighting. Glittering crowds.
Just ahead of segment three of this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show, just kind of summing up some conclusions from the election. And it's good this is over because now we can get back to regular stuff. And this is going to be the last of the really long podcasts on this stuff. I've done three or four big political podcasts. Obviously, we just had an election, had to do the state by state stuff, had to do election coverage, and have to do this. So after this, we'll start branching out and doing some shorter, more fun podcasts. And fun is what it's all about. Sometimes we can get too serious. And this is the season when companies start doing these team building exercises. They can get really serious, especially if you're one of these companies that is partial to the hotel conference room. And people sit in there, and I remember going and doing these things for companies, and you get
there at 9 o'clock, if you're lucky, you know, and you're just falling asleep by 10:30, you know, you have to take numerous breaks. How about doing something that really does build the team in a really creative way, rather than these crazy things that companies do for team building exercises? And I'd like to suggest Brush Studio in the West End in St. Louis Park, where there's plenty of parking. Brush Studio events are held in a relaxed social setting. Here's what happens. It's really simple. An artist guides your team through a featured painting step by step. It's not paint by numbers. They're actually making a painting, and people are amazed about what they can do. And the end up result is that it's a great opportunity for everybody on your team to bond. They don't have to walk across coals. They don't have to sit in a conference room all day. And Brush Studio events are designed for people who really favor the left brain to bring out the creative side, to bring out the right brain. And that's going to mean ideas for you, and it's going to mean a great experience for your new diverse workforce in today's world. And it is a lot better than spending all day in a hotel conference room with cold coffee. 55 people, you know, plenty of room there, catering from Crave on the West End, so everybody's going to have something to eat and have a good time. 22 brands of beer and an extensive wine collection. I can just tell you that they are really event planning ninjas at Brush Studio. They're going to make the event special and unique, which is why they say a unique brush with art instead of coming away with bruises, scrapes from rappelling, or, you know, just being exhausted from one of these conference room meetings. They come away with the painting, and a lot of people will hang it in their office and they'll love it. So check it out, brushstudio.net, or you can check them out by simply clicking on the banner at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page for that'll take you to their Facebook page. Lots of video there, or you can call them old school, 952-236-1700. That's 952-236-1700. Brushstudio.net. Okay, here's segment three of this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. You're hearing the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. To sign up for the Bob Davis Podcast newsletter, The Bob Line, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. For more of the podcasts, also visit thebobdavispodcast.com. So as I said in the previous segment, lots of misconceptions about what happened on election night and what's gonna happen. And even more about the winner of the election, President-elect Donald J. Trump. And a lack of memory about what happened at both political conventions this summer and how that impacts the current time frame. This is what I mean by context. A couple of things. First of all, here's one of my favorites. The polls were wrong. That's what everybody said the night of the election and the morning after. Now, if you listen to me, if you listen to the podcast, you know that I studied the state-by-state polls, doing several podcasts and, of course, three radio shows detailing where the polls stood on the eve of election 2016. Polls are not right or wrong. They are either within the margin of error or not. They are snapshots at any given time. They can say one thing or they can say another. It isn't necessarily right or wrong. It is the media that has held these polls up as tarot cards that say this is what's going to happen. Now, as you know, the United States does not elect its presidents by popular vote. We've certainly seen that in this election. We elect our presidents by the Electoral College. And if you want to predict an election, then you have to look at individual state polls, because it's all about proportional electors, slates being elected in states with winner-take-all votes, and so forth and so on. You have to look at individual state polls if you want to know what's going on, if you want to understand what is going on. And the first rule of polling is you cannot use polling to predict an outcome or result. Polling measures perceptions, behaviors of consumers, and the differences between the two. You cannot trend polls done by different pollsters. You cannot aggregate polls and assign an index based on adding them all up and averaging them for a potential
political candidate to win. And the first rule of presidential polling is you cannot look at the national preference polls. They are meaningless. They are simply nothing more than scorecards for news anchors to talk about every night. Now, as you know, I look closely, at the state polls throughout the election season. And on election night, I looked again. And this is what I found out. Most of the final state-by-state polls and averages were within the margin of error for the presidential election. I said it during my election night coverage. That is, they predicted a tie. It was simply too close to call. Throughout the evening, the actual numbers were very close statistically in Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, and especially in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin up to the very end. Now, in an election, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. Somebody's going to have more votes than the other. So you're not looking at a statistical issue. You're looking at a number of votes, literally 3,225 versus 3,110, right? One of them's going to win, one of them's going to lose. So technically speaking, those polls were not incorrect. They were showing a tie. In other words, you couldn't say this is going to be the outcome here. It isn't always like that. When you get a wide margin that's within the margin of error and you say, I think this is going to happen and you're wrong, well, then you are wrong. But that did not happen this time. For example, I told you the fact that Trump had led in Ohio all summer was significant. I told you that the Republican experience with recall and two gubernatorial elections and four legislative cycles in the state of Wisconsin meant Republicans understood the challenge of getting their vote out. And they helped Ron Johnson win re-election and, of course, Donald Trump take the state. But many people paid attention to the media's penchant for national polls and snake oil salesmen and their indexes showing it would be a close election, but Clinton would win. And they weren't so wrong so much as they were looking at the wrong things and drawing the wrong conclusions, making predictions that they couldn't make. So elections are made not on response to polls or previous election results or tea leaf predictions. Elections are made by those who show up to vote. Period. In 2016, Hillary Clinton's vote did not materialize the way it had for Barack Obama in 2008 and to a lesser extent in 2012. If it had, she would be the president-elect. And Donald Trump was able to spur enough people to go to the polls and vote for him in those key states. That is why he won. For all these people saying it's because of this, it's because of that, they don't know why the people voted the way they did. They just know that they voted at this point. Exit polls be damned. I said before the election, no one can predict an election. No one can predict this election because it all depends on who actually shows up to vote. And of course, that turned out to be the best prediction, and I am quite proud of it because in the end, I stuck to my guns of just refusing to say what was going to happen because you couldn't tell. People voting is what matters, one way or the other in elections. No matter how bad the information is, in the end, it's all about votes cast, not talk. So it is the same now for who Trump represents and what he will do when he is in office. People say to me, I know he's going to do the things he said he will. Well, what did he say he would do? Who knows? How is that conservative or Republican? Or people say he's going to do all these terrible things and it's going to be the end of the world. Well, how do you know? You know, the other thing I say and I see everywhere because the media is saying it, especially the mainstream media, because they don't understand what happened is, Donald Trump is an anti-establishment guy, therefore the establishment lost. Given that assessment, we are expected to believe that an unorthodox Trump presidency will be successful. It will include a grab bag of so-called conservative policy ideas to get things done, but he is anti-establishment. Like what? Well, you know, conservative justices, for example. I'll come back to that later. So Trump is an anti-establishment guy, and he has beaten the establishment. But let's look at what remains. Rents Priebus is still the party chair. Paul Ryan is still the speaker. Mitch McConnell is still the Senate majority leader. The Democrats picked up two seats, I think, in the Senate, six in the House. The establishment made a deal with Trump at the RNC, a deal which left them firmly in control of the party, the House, and the Senate, and reduced the influence of the Tea Party and evangelistically influenced Ted Cruz supporters, much as they had done to the people who were libertarian, vocally so, for Ron Paul at Tampa in 2008. it will be argued, actually 2012, it is going to be argued, and with good reason, that if President Obama's base had turned out for Clinton, as I said, this year would have looked very much different than it did. It would have looked much more like 2016, with Trump slash Romney losing Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania to Clinton in close races. It worked out the other way. President-elect Trump's transition team, moreover, is managed by a Boston consulting group, a business consulting firm boasting close ties to the Brookings Institution, Council on Foreign Relations, Heritage, and American Enterprise Institutes, all in later years very much a part of the Washington establishment, with both centrist Democrats and international businesses as at their core, and moderate Republican leadership. So if the establishment stopped a floor fight, which might have resulted in Trump losing the nomination in Cleveland, and if the establishment is in control of the House and Senate, a lot of the bureaucracy, presidential transition team, as well as the state governorships and state legislatures, are moderate Republicans. How is it then that Trump is anti-establishment? Because Fox News says he is, or the New York Times says he is. Finally, the United States is a representative republic. Very quickly, a good many of the enumerated powers are vested constitutionally in the legislative branch. A good many of the unenumerated powers are vested constitutionally in the states. The presidency is not a dictatorship yet, although more robust than prior to Abraham Lincoln. It is a political office. That is, the president must amass and spend political capital to get things done. That means working with establishment Republicans and Democrats. For example, submitting a list of 20 so-called conservative justices is one thing, but getting it through a majority vote in the Senate that is split between the two parties is another one. So with the treaties, he isn't going to be able to do those things without the establishment, because they are still firmly in control of Capitol Hill and the bureaucracy of the executive branch and our government. Well, this is what happens when you predict outcomes. You are surprised. So don't be surprised, because I've just told you the truth. Outcomes won't happen without the continued pressure on legislatures, and that is going to come with intense pressures from the left over the next 4 years. If you're a Trump supporter, what are you going to do? Coming up, I still believe we're in the process of political realignment in this country, and I'm going to talk about that and sum things up. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Boo. Well, thanks to the digital sponsor, the BobDavisPodcast.com, all these weeks, Alpha Systems, what do they do? Well, you've heard me talk about Alpha Systems before. Basically, if you're a pilot, the whole thing is you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings. Biggest problem in general aviation, as I have talked about, is pilots making that final turn to the runway sometimes don't realize how much lift is underneath the airplane. Some of these guys think that they can feel it. Others understand that you need to have a visual indicator of the amount of lift underneath your aircraft so you can safely make that turn. And Alpha Systems makes the best angle of attack indicator, because they use the best visual interface. So when you turn, you can really see how much power you need to add, and that's what keeps you safe. And Alpha Systems' motto is, pilots fly safe. Why not? Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. Click on the Alpha Systems banners for more info about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator. They want to get it into your plane today at thebobdavispodcast.com. They're at the top of the page there. And again, thanks to people for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast on Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, BlogTalkRadio.com, the radio show at The Patriot on Sunday nights at 11 p.m. I really appreciate the likes and the shares, the comments on iTunes especially, and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I'm on YouTube. I just put the travel videos up for YouTube. I'm not putting a bunch of political stuff up there, although I did do some videos on election night on Facebook. Really appreciate the interest and the donations for Mobile Podcast Command, which is now quietly waiting for the next mission. And you can check all that stuff out at thebobdavispodcast.com. Sign up for the newsletter. Listen to the stream off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. Some of the phones, the stream initiates just like on the page. Others, you have to initiate it, but it's a great way to listen to the podcast. We rotate the last three podcasts on the stream at thebobdavispodcast.com. So thanks for listening. All right, here's segment four of this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. For more of the podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. So welcome back. To return to the theme at the beginning of the show in the first segment, yes, I've seen most of the country this year. And if I can wax poetic, I would say from the cornfields of Iowa to the mountains and beaches of the Northwest, to from Seattle to San Francisco to Los Angeles, you know, from Big Sur to Carmel Beach to the deserts to the industrial heartland, the South, the Mid-South, and the Midwest, from North Dakota to Texas, from the mountains to the plains, all the way to the Gulf and the Eastern Seaboard, I've seen most of the country, literally driven through most of the country, big towns, small towns, everything. And it is a big, vibrant, and really still very wealthy, prosperous country. And we don't hear about that enough in the media because we're too busy being told it's falling apart. Most people in this country have access to state-of-the-art communications, banking, manufacturing, marketing, travel, and transportation services. They have, a bunch of choices when it comes to products and services at all kinds of business outlets. The roads are in great shape, despite what they keep telling us. Most cities are still growing, especially in the South and Western states. There are all kinds of new ideas being manifested in the creative businesses, but also in agriculture, in transportation, in banking, investment, air travel, in services, in technology, especially in technology infrastructure. Despite all that is being said everywhere, I saw a prosperous, busy people with qualifications. Of course, some places aren't doing so well, but on balance, I don't see a country that's on the verge of falling apart. I just don't. And, you know, a lot of people don't like it when you say that, but I can say it because I saw it. But there are some key questions that we need to answer in this country and problems we need to solve if we want to be as prosperous and happy as we can be, and if we can, you know, build or predicate the next industrial revolution that is coming, whether we want it to come or not. What is the proper role and size of government? Who do we let into this country? What should our foreign policy regarding the rest of the world be? How do we trade with the rest of the world and enhance our ability to compete and win in that environment? How do we take advantage of technology developments? What is the proper level of taxation? What kind of money should we use? And that's just my list. There's also the reality that we are not all in agreement about how we live our lives or how to answer just those few questions. We're on the verge, as I said, of major demographic changes in this country, major business changes, major industrial changes, but really demographic changes as the baby boom population begins to relinquish the reins of power. Remember, Hillary Clinton is 68 years old. Donald Trump is 70. So this generation, this baby boom generation, is relinquishing the reins of power to the so-called Gen X, millennials, and even the so-called Generation Z coming in. And we're on the verge of major demographic changes as Asian, Hispanic, and Black voters are going to outnumber white voters in key states like California and other places. Now, you could say one group, those on the left, want a collective socialist-style government that takes care of people from cradle to grave, closely regulates and taxes businesses, and fights for the oppressed and those who are perceived to have been oppressed by our government in the past. Those on the right supposedly want less spending, less government, less interference, to let bygones be bygones, less taxes and regulation, and let people alone, and they want so-called traditional American values. You could say one is younger and more diverse, the other is older, male, and less diverse. The problem is, that is an inaccurate picture of the electorate. I don't think anybody can tell you where these people are sort of agglomerating right now, binding up or bulking up in terms of where they fall out as groups. And what you're seeing in the media, what you're seeing in a lot of political research, what you're seeing in a lot of this stuff really isn't an accurate picture of the direction of the people, let alone the direction of both parties, which aren't addressing these groups because they're losing their footing. And I mean, the Democrats lost their footing too in this election cycle. It isn't an accurate picture on the media and television and so forth of the political spectrum in the United States or the world right now. I'm not even sure the right-left political spectrum makes any sense either. If there is one overriding phrase or sentence or point of view that unites people from this election that I heard everywhere, I don't care where it was, the thing that actually unites us is that people are sick to death of the political elite impinging on our social media feeds, our TV shows, our conversations in our lives. That includes politicians, and it includes people in the media. And for market anarchists and libertarians and others who believe the pernicious power of government is enormous these days, this is the best possible outcome of this whole thing, that people have reached the point where they distrust the political class. And I don't think the political elite in either party are in touch with what is going on out there, because they're not out there watching and talking to the people, and they're not listening. Now, I can't tell you what's going on. I went out, and I've been out, and I'll continue to go out. But getting to the bottom of what is going on is a lot more difficult than just driving around looking at things. The Democratic Party forced Hillary Clinton down the throats of its rank and file, and they lost. The Republican Party created a circus roadshow that resulted in the establishment embracing a reality TV star because they did not want to allow the rank and file in the party to hash out who their nominee should be, because then they would have had to relinquish power. That is anti-establishment. In both cases, the political parties have lost their strongest supporters. And here's the nut of the thing. These choices that we have to make, they are critical. And the next president is going to have to make them. They are going to be controversial no matter what he does. No matter who is president over the next few cycles, you're going to see controversy. And that controversy is going to be, the kind of controversy that creates these powerful emotional reactions, especially from aggrieved parties, and especially if the aggrieved are on the left. The left will use all kinds of tactics to build support for their agenda, demonstrations, things of that nature. Looking forward to the 2018 cycle. And believe me, they'll start on it the next day after the election. They will attack Trump relentlessly. None of this, we're all in one boat and we all, the president and Trump saying, it's time for us to work together. You can forget about that. What we saw this week at Berkeley and Washington State and in Minneapolis with the mayor's Facebook post telling people they should be enraged, this is only the beginning. They will be in the streets for the Democrats in the House and Senate to put pressure on Republicans, and especially the pusillanimous Republicans in the House and Senate. If you supported Trump, where will you be? If he leans to the left, where will you be? If he does things you don't agree with, where will you be? And passive support, by the way, is not support. So what is the so-called right or the Trump voters prepared to do for President Trump once the rubber hits the road? Will they abandon him, or will they be out there in the streets with the Democrats pushing on this and fighting on this? Finally, there is a political alignment going on, as I said, and within 10 years, I do believe that there will be two new political parties. That is a process that is taking place as we speak, whether people are on board or not, because there are movements that are going to find support and are going to coalesce, whether it's libertarians or socialists. So another real question is, how do you support the existing Democratic Party or the Republican Party, considering that both support the establishment or status quo, which really is big government republicanism on one side and collectivism on the other, and getting government involved and getting government, to impinge on local structures and businesses and higher taxes and everything else. So, when you look at the spectrum and you look at each side and what they're doing, it's really not two sides. I, for one, am going to continue to travel and to help people tell their stories for you to hear. And I thought at one point when I was coming back from my mega trip just before the election, I thought to myself as I drove through the rain and fog in Iowa, why am I coming home? And I thought, well, I'm coming home to vote. That's one thing I'm going to do. And I'm coming home to pick up my mail. That was the other thing I'm going to do. But I wanted to get right back out there, because it's amazing to travel and meet and learn and grow from that process. And I'm going to continue to avoid the partisan processes because it's not for me anymore. And I'm going to continue to avoid outcome-based predictions or expectations and advocacy, because what we're talking about, what I'm talking about, what I'm interested in is meeting and talking to people and watching this process unfold in this country as we go through this change in the two-party system that we currently have to a new two-party system. Even if I have visceral disagreements with people, it's all about what makes up this rich fabric of American politics. And I'm going to continue to refuse to tell you what to think or what to do, other than to continue to encourage people to go within and listen to their own thoughts, to take action, to ration the screen time, and to try to get some context, and also to witness these tectonic political, social, and economic changes that are already happening in the world and are about to happen to this country and the world. I mean, it's the difference between going up on the Upper Peninsula and seeing the old industrial north and just being agog with my mouth open driving down through Northern California and seeing Silicon Valley and Palo Alto and seeing this tremendous, this hearth of technology that starts at Seattle, goes all the way down to Los Angeles and south of there. So that is all coming up. Happy 2016 election. And now it's on to the future. That's going to do it for this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. For all the podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. Bye-bye. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts Radio Show. Well, thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show number 52. This is podcast 571. Don't forget Brush Studio in the West End. If you are planning any kind of team building exercises for your company, especially if you have a diverse workforce, it's really fun. Trust me. Your people will come away with a great experience, and that's really what it's all about. 952-236-1700, 952-236-1700, or check them out online at brushstudio.net. And you can click on that banner at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast page. It takes you to their Facebook page. And also, I have to say, don't forget Hydrus. I love Hydrus. Hydrus transformed my yoga practice. It helps me get down to the grit. I'm so glad I got my pile of Hydrus that I can use now. I've done 8 yoga classes, actually 9 in 8 days. So I'm going to take a little break today, but I feel great. Visit HydrusPerformance.com. Whatever you do, HYDRUS, HydrusPerformance.com, HydrusPerformance.com. And I love my Hydrus. I'm so glad I got some Hydrus now. Okay, so now this long, masochistic 2-year presidential election cycle is over with, and I'm so happy about that, and we can get back to more fun type of pursuits. There's probably a few more loose ends to tie up that I'll get to in future podcasts, but I just want to say very quickly, and I'll probably do a podcast about this, going out and covering the primaries, going out and traveling, and again, thanks for the donations for Mobile Podcast Command, is probably the best thing I could have done to give me the kind of insight that I feel made a huge difference in not endorsing, in not predicting, in not telling you what to do, in not telling you what will happen. And I'm really, really grateful for that. And I'm going to do this again for the next presidential cycle in terms of just going out and covering the primaries, although in a much more robust way. And I'm really, really excited to think about that and plan for that. And there's going to be a lot of fun podcasts this winter and summer and fall and spring coming in the next year. So it's time to get back to our prosaic pursuits. This election cycle is mercifully over. And thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast, podcast 571, radio show number 52. Back to the coffee. Where's my coffee? Wake up and smell the coffee. Ugh.